Side 6. Count Zero by William Gibson. Continuing on page 188. What I was working on, up until I heard Lucas had been hit, was running down the Lobes who mugged Bobby for his deck. That was probably an accident, just business as usual. But somewhere, there's a couple of Lobes with our icebreaker. That had potential, for sure, because the Lobes are hot doggers, some of them, and they do a little business with Two-A-Day. So Two-A-Day and I were making the rounds, looking to learn what we could, which was Dick, as it turned out, except that while we were with this dust case called Alix, whose second assistant warlord or something, he gets a call from his opposite number, who Two-A-Day pins as a Berrytown Gothic name of Raymond. He was unloading the pack as he spoke, laying out weapons, tools, ammunition, coils of wire. Raymond wants to talk real bad, but Alix is too cool to do it in front of us. Sorry, gentlemen, but this is official warlord biz, this dumb shit says. So natch we excuse our humble selves, shuffle and bow and all, and nip around the corner. Use Two-A-Day's modular phone to ring up our cowboys back in the sprawl and put them onto Alix's phone, but fast. Those cowboys went into Alix's conversation with Raymond like a wire into cheese. He pulled a deformed 12-gauge shotgun, barely longer than his forearm, from the pack, selected a fat drum magazine from the display he'd made on the carpet, and clicked the two together. You ever see one of these motherfuckers? South African. Pre-war. Something in his voice and the set of his jaw made Bobby suddenly aware of his contained fury. Seems Raymond has been approached by this guy, and this guy has lots of money, and he wants to hire the Gothics outright, the whole apparat, to go into the sprawl and do a number, a real crowd scene. This guy wants it so big, he's going to hire the casuals, too. Well, the shit hit the fan then, because Alix, he's kind of conservative. Only good casuals, a dead one, and then only after X number of hours of torture, etc. Fuck that, Raymond says, ever the diplomat. We're talking big money here. We're talking corporate. He opened a box of fat red plastic shells and began to load the gun, cranking one after another into the magazine. Now, I could be way off, but I keep seeing these mass biolabs PR types on video lately. Something very weird's happened, out on some property of theirs in Arizona. Some people say it was a nuke. Some people say it was something else. And now they're claiming their top Biosoft man's dead in what they call an unrelated accident. That's Mitchell, the guy who more or less invented this stuff. So far, nobody else is even pretending to be able to make a biochip. So Lucas and I assumed from the beginning that Maas had made that icebreaker. If it was an icebreaker. But we had no idea who the Finn got it from, or where they got it. But if you put all that together, it looks like Maas Biolabs might be out to cook us all. And this is where they plan to do it, because they got us here but good. I don't know, Jammer said. We got a lot of friends in this building. Had. Beauvoir put the shotgun down and started loading a Nambu automatic. Most of the people on this level and the next one down got bought out this afternoon. Cash. Duffels full of it. There's a few holdouts, but not enough.
It doesn't make any sense, Jackie said, taking the glass of scotch from Jammer's hand and drinking it straight off. What do we have that anybody could want that bad?
Hey, Bobby said, don't forget, they probably don't know those Lobes ripped me for the icebreaker. Maybe that's all they want. No, Beauvoir said, snapping the magazine into the Nambu. Because they couldn't have known you hadn't stashed it in your mother's place, right?
But maybe they went there and looked.
So how did they know Lucas wasn't carrying it in Ahmed? Jammer said, walking back to the bar.
Finn thought someone sent those three ninjas to kill him, too, Bobby said. Said they had stuff to make him answer questions first, though.
Maas again, Beauvoir said. Whoever, here's the deal with the casuals and Gothics. We'd know more, but Alix the Lobe got on his high horse and wouldn't parley with Raymond. No co-employment with the hated casuals. Here, as our cowboys could make out, the army's outside to keep you people in, and to keep people like me out, people with guns and stuff. He handed the loaded Nambu to Jackie.
You know how to use a gun? He asked Bobby. Sure, Bobby lied. No, Jammer said. We got enough trouble without arming him, Jesus Christ.
What all that suggests to me, Beauvoir said, is that we can expect somebody else to come in after us. Somebody a little more professional.
Unless they just blow Hypermart all to shit and gone, Jammer said, and all those zombies with it.
No, Bobby said, or else they'd already have done it.
They all stared at him.
Give the boy credit, Jackie said. He's got it right.
30 minutes later, and Jammer was staring glumly at Beauvoir. I gotta hand it to you. That's the most half-assed plan I've heard in a long time.
Yeah, Beauvoir, Bobby cut in. Why can't we just crawl back up that vent, sneak across the roof, and get over to the next building? Use the line you came over on.
There's casuals on the roof like flies on shit, Beauvoir said. Some of them might even have brain enough to have found the cap I opened to get down here. I left a couple of baby frag mines on my way in.
He grinned mirthlessly.
Aside from that, the building next door is taller. I had to go up on that roof and shoot the monomole down to this one. You can't hand over hand up monomolecular filament. Your fingers fall off.
And how the hell did you expect to get out? Bobby said.
Drop it, Bobby, Jackie said quietly.
Beauvoir's done what he had to do. Now he's in here with us, and we're armed.
Bobby, Beauvoir said, why don't you run the plan back to us? Make sure we understand it. Bobby had the uncomfortable feeling that Beauvoir wanted to make sure he understood it, but he leaned back against the bar and began.
We get ourselves all armed up and we wait, okay? Jammer and I, we go out with his deck and scout around the matrix. Maybe we get some idea what's happening.
I think I can handle that by myself, Jammer said.
Shit.
Bobby was off the bar.
Beauvoir said, I want to go. I want a Jack. How am I ever supposed to learn anything?
Never mind, Bobby, Jackie said. You go on.
Okay, Bobby said sulkily. So, sooner or later, the guys who hired the Gothics and Casuals to keep us here, they're going to come for us. When they do, we take them. We get at least one of them alive. Same time, we're on our way out, and the Goths and all, they won't expect all the firepower. So we get to the street and head for the projects.
I think that about covers it, Jammer said, strolling across the carpet to the locked and curtained door.
I think that about sums it up. He pressed his thumb against the coated latch plate and pulled the door half open.
Hey, you! He bellowed. Not you! You with the hat! Get your ass over here! I want to talk!
The pencil-thin red beam pierced door and curtain, two of Jammer's fingers, and winked over the bar. A bottle exploded, its contents billowing out as steam and vaporized esters. Jammer let the door swing shut again, stared at his ruined hand, then sat down hard on the carpet. The club slowly filled with the Christmas tree smell of boiled gin. Beauvoir took a silver pressure bottle from the bar counter and hosed the smoldering curtain with seltzer until the CO2 cartridge was exhausted and the stream faltered.
You're in luck, Bobby, Beauvoir said, tossing the bottle over his shoulder. Cause Brother Jammer, he ain't gonna be punching any deck.
Jackie was making clucking sounds over Jammer's hand, kneeling down. Bobby caught a glimpse of cauterized flesh, then quickly looked away.
26. The Wig.
You know, Rez said, hanging upside down in front of Marley, it's strictly no biz of mine, but is somebody maybe expecting you when we get there? I mean, I'm taking you there for sure, and if you can't get in, I'll take you back to JAL term. But if nobody wants to let you in, I don't know how long I want to hang around. That thing's scrap, and we get some funny people hanging out in the hulks out here.
Rez, or Therese, Marley gathered from the laminated pilot's license clipped to the Sweet Jane console, had removed her canvas work vest for the trip. Marley, numb with the rainbow of derms Rez had pasted along her wrist to counteract the convulsive nausea of space adaptation syndrome, stared at the rose tattoo. It had been executed in a Japanese style, hundreds of years old, and Marley woozily decided that she liked it. That, in fact, she liked Rez, who was at once hard and girlish and concerned for her strange passenger. Rez had admired her leather jacket and purse before bundling them into a kind of narrow nylon net hammock, already stuffed with cassettes, print books, and unwashed clothing.
"I don't know," Marley managed. "I'll just have to try to get in. You know what that thing is, sister?"
Rez was adjusting the G-web around Marley's shoulders and armpits.
"What thing?"
"Where we're going. It's part of the old Tessier Ashpool cores. Used to be the mainframes for their corporate memory."
"I've heard of them," Marley said, closing her eyes. "Andrea told me."
"Sure, everybody's heard of them. They used to own all of Freeside, built it even. Then they went tits up and sold out, had their family place cut off the spindle and towed to another orbit, and they had the cores wiped before they did that, and torched them off and sold them to a scrapper. The scrapper's never done anything with them. I never heard anybody was squatting there, but out here you live where you can. I guess that's true for anybody. Like they say that Lady Jane, old Ashpool's daughter, she's still living in their old place, stone crazy." She gave the G-Web a last professional tug.
"Okay, you just relax. I'm going to burn Jane hard for 20 minutes, but it'll get us there fast, which I figure is what you're paying for."
And Marley slid back into a landscape built all of boxes, vast wooden Cornell constructions, where the solid residues of love and memory were displayed behind rain-streaked sheets of dusty glass, and the figure of the mysterious boxmaker fled before her down avenues paved with mosaics of human teeth, Marley's Paris boots clicking blindly over symbols outlined in dull gold crowns. The boxmaker was male and wore Alain's green jacket, and feared her above all things.
"I'm sorry," she cried, running after him. "I'm sorry."
"Yeah. Thérèse Lorenz, the sweet Jane. You want the numbers?"
"What?"
"Yeah, sure we're pirates. I'm Captain fucking Hook already. Look, Jack, let me give you the numbers. You can check it out."
"I said already. I got a passenger. Request permission at goddamn cetera. Marley something. Speaks French in her sleep."
Marley's lids flickered, opened. Rez was webbed in front of her, each small muscle of her back precisely defined.
"Hey," Rez said, twisting around in the web. "I'm sorry. I raised them for you, but they sound pretty flaky. You religious?"
"No," Marley said, baffled. Rez made a face.
"Well, I hope you can make sense out of this shit, then."
She shrugged out of the web and executed a tight backward somersault that brought her within centimeters of Marley's face. An optic ribbon trailed from her hand to the console, and for the first time Marley saw the delicate sky-blue socket set flush with the skin of the girl's wrist. She popped a speaker bead into Marley's right ear and adjusted the transparent microphone tube that curved down from it.
"You have no right to disturb us here," a man's voice said. "Our work is the work of God, and we alone have seen His true face."
"Hello? Hello, can you hear me? My name is Marley Krushkova, and I have urgent business with you, or with someone at these coordinates. My business concerns a series of boxes, collages. The maker of these boxes may be in terrible danger. I must see him."
"Danger?" The man coughed. "God alone decides man's fate. We are entirely without fear, but neither are we fools.
Please listen to me. I was hired by Josef Virek to locate the maker of the boxes, but now I have come to warn you. Virek knows you are here, and his agents will follow me."
Rez was staring at her hard.
"You must let me in. I can tell you more."
"Virek."
There was a long, static-filled pause.
"Josef Virek?"
"Yes," Marley said, "that one.
You've seen his picture all your life, the one with the King of England. Please, please.
Give me your pilot, the voice said, and the bluster and hysteria were gone, replaced with something Marley liked even less.
It's a spare, Rez said, snapping the mirrored helmet from the red suit. I can afford it. You paid me enough.
No, Marley protested. Really, you needn't. I...
She shook her head. Rez was undoing the fastenings at the spacesuit's waist.
You don't go into a thing like that without a suit, she said. You don't know what they got for atmosphere. You don't even know they got atmosphere. And any kind of bacteria, spores...
What's the matter? Lowering the silver helmet.
I'm claustrophobic.
Oh. Rez stared at her. I heard of that. It means you're scared to be inside things. She looked genuinely curious.
Small things, yes. Like Sweet Jane?
Yes, but... She glanced at the cramped cabin, fighting her panic.
I can stand this. But not the helmet.
She shuddered.
Well, Rez said, tell you what. We get you into the suit, but we leave the helmet off. I'll teach you how to fasten it. Deal? Otherwise, you don't leave my ship.
Her mouth was straight and firm.
Yes, Marley said. Yes.
Here's the drill, Rez said. We're lock to lock. This hatch opens, you get in. I close it. Then I open the other side. Then you're in whatever passes for atmosphere in there. You sure you don't want the helmet on?
No, Marley said, looking down at the helmet she grasped in the suit's red gauntlet, at her pale reflection in the mirrored faceplate.
Rez made a little clicking sound with her tongue.
Your life. If you want to get back, have them put a message through JAL term for the Sweet Jane.
Marley kicked off clumsily and spun forward into the lock, no larger than an upright coffin. The red suit's breastplate clicked hard against the outer hatch, and she heard the inner one hiss shut behind her. A light came on beside her head, and she thought of the lights in refrigerators.
Goodbye, Therese.
Nothing happened. She was alone with the beating of her heart. Then the Sweet Jane's outer hatch slid open. A slight pressure differential was enough to tumble her out into a darkness that smelled old and sadly human. A smell like a long-abandoned locker room. There was a thickness, an unclean dampness to the air. And still tumbling, she saw Sweet Jane's hatch slide shut behind her. A beam of light stabbed past her, wavered, swung, and found her spinning.
Lights! Someone bawled hoarsely. Lights for our guest! Jones!
It was the voice she'd heard through the ear bead. It rang strangely in the iron vastness of this place, this hollow she fell through. And then there was a grating sound, and a distant ring of harsh blue flared up, showing her the far curve of a wall or hull of steel and welded lunar rock. The surface was lined and pitted with precisely carved channels and depressions, where equipment of some kind had once been fitted. Scabrous clumps of brown expansion foam still adhered in some of the deeper cuts, and others were lost in dead black shadow.
You'd better get a line on her, Jones, before she cracks her head.
Something struck the shoulder of her suit with a damp smack, and she turned her head to see a pink gob of bright plastic trailing a fine pink line, which jerked taut as she watched, flipping her around. The derelict cathedral space filled with the laboring whine of an engine. And quite slowly, they reeled her in.
It took you long enough, the voice said. I wondered who would be first, and now it's Virek. Mammon.
And then they had her, spinning her around. She almost lost the helmet. It was drifting away, but one of them batted it back into her hands. Her purse, with her boots and jacket folded inside, executed its own arc on its shoulder strap. And bumped the side of her head.
Who are you? She asked.
Ludgate, the old man roared. Wigan Ludgate, as you well know. Who else did he send you to deceive?
His seamed, blotched face was clean-shaven, but his gray, untrimmed hair floated free, seaweed on a tide of stale air.
"I'm sorry," she said. "I'm not here to deceive you. I no longer work for Viorek. I came here because... I mean, I'm not at all sure why I came here to begin with, but on my way I learned that the artist who makes the boxes is in danger, because there's something else, something Viorek thinks he has, something Viorek thinks will free him from his cancers."
Her words ran down to silence in the face of the almost palpable craziness that radiated from Wigan Ludgate, and she saw that he wore the cracked plastic carapace of an old work suit, with cheap metal crucifixes epoxied like a necklace around the tarnished steel helmet ring. His face was very close. She could smell his decaying teeth.
"The boxes!"
Little balls of spittle curled off his lips, obeying the elegant laws of Newtonian physics.
"You whore! They're of the hand of God!"
"Easy there, lad," said a second voice. "You're scaring the lady. Easy, lady, 'cause old Lud, he hasn't got too many visitors. Gets him quite worked up, you see, but he's basically a harmless old bugger."
She turned her head and met the relaxed gaze of a pair of wide blue eyes in a very young face.
"I'm Jones," he said. "I live here, too."
Wigan Ludgate threw back his head and howled, and the sound rang wild against the walls of steel and stone.
"Mostly, you see," Jones was saying as Marley pulled her way behind him along a knotted line stretched taut down a corridor that seemed to have no end. "He's pretty quiet. Listens to his voices, you know. Talks to himself, or maybe to the voices, I don't know. And then a spell comes on him and he's like this."
When he stopped speaking, she could still hear faint echoes of Ludgate's howls.
"You may think it's cruel, me leaving him this way, but it's best, really. He'll tire of it soon. Gets hungry. Then he comes to find me. Wants his tuck, you see."
"Are you Australian?" she asked.
"New Melbourne," he said. "Or was, before I got up the well."
"Do you mind my asking why you're here? I mean, here in this... this... what is it?"
The boy laughed.
"Mostly I call it the place. Lud, he calls it a lot of things, but mostly the kingdom. Figures he's found God, he does. Suppose he has, if you want to look at it that way. Near as I can make it, he was some kind of console crook before he got up the well. Don't know how he came to be here, exactly, other than that it suits the poor bastard. Me, I came here running, understand? Trouble somewhere, not to be too specific, and my arse for out of there. Turn up here. That's a long tale of its own. And here's bloody Ludgate, near to starving. He's had him a sort of business, selling things he'd scavenge, and those boxes you're after. But he'd gotten a bit far gone for that. His buyers would come, oh, say, 3 times a year, but he'd send them away. Well, I thought, the hiding here's as good as any, so I took to helping him. That's it, I guess."
"Can you take me to the artist? Is he here? It's extremely urgent."
"I'll take you, no fear. But this place... it was never really built for people, not to get around in, I mean, so it's a bit of a journey. It isn't likely to be going anywhere, though. Can't guarantee it'll make a box for you. Do you really work for Viorek? Fabulous rich old shit on the telly? Kraut, isn't he?"
"I did," she said, "for a number of days.
As for nationality, I would guess Herr Viorek is the sole citizen of a nation consisting of Herr Viorek."
"See what you mean," Joan said cheerily. "It's all the same with these rich old fucks, I suppose, though it's more fun than watching a bloody zaibatsu. You won't see a zaibatsu come to a messy end, will you? Take old Ashpool, countryman of mine he was, who built all this. They say his own daughter slit his throat, and now she's bad as old Lud, holed up in the family castle somewhere, the place being a former part of all that, you see."
"My pilot said something like that.
And a friend of mine in Paris mentioned the Tessier Ashpools recently. The clan is in eclipse."
"Eclipse? Lord, down the bloody tubes more like it. Think about it. We're crawling, you and me, through what used to be their corporate data cores. Some contractor in Pakistan bought the thing. Hull's fine, and there's a fair bit of gold in the circuitry, but not as cheap to recover as some might like. It's been hanging up here ever since, with only old Lud to keep it company, and it him. Till I come along, that is. Guess one day the cruise'll come up from Pakistan and get cuttin'. Funny, though, how much of it still seems to work, at least part of the time. Story I heard, one got me here in the first place, said TA's wiped the cores dead before they cut it loose.
But you think they are still operative?
Lord, yes. About the way Lud is, if you call that operative. What do you think your boxmaker is?
What do you know about Mass Biolabs?
Mass what?
Mass. They make biochips.
Oh, them. Well, that's all I do know about them.
Ludgate speaks of them.
He might. Can't say as I listen all that close. Lud, he does speak a fair bit.
27. Stations of the Breath. He brought them in through avenues lined with rusting slopes of dead vehicles, with wreckers' cranes and the black towers of smelters. He kept to the back streets as they eased into the western flank of the sprawl, and eventually gunned the hover down a brick canyon, armored sides scraping sparks, and drove it hard into a wall of soot-blown, compacted garbage. An avalanche of refuse slid down, almost covering the vehicle, and he released the controls, watching the foam dice swing back and forth, side to side. The kerosene gauge had been riding on empty for the last 12 blocks.
"What happened back there?" she said, her cheekbones green in the glow of the instruments.
"I shot down a helicopter, mostly by accident. We were lucky."
"No, I mean after that. I had a dream."
"What did you dream?"
"The big things, moving."
"You had some kind of seizure."
"Am I sick? Do you think I'm sick? Why did the company want to kill me?"
"I don't think you're sick." She undid her harness and scrambled back over the seat to crouch where they had slept.
"It was a bad dream."
She began to tremble. He climbed out of his harness and went to her, held her head against him, stroking her hair, smoothing it back against the delicate skull, stroking it back behind her ears. Her face in the green glow like something hauled from dreams and abandoned, the skin smooth and thin across the bones. The black sweatshirt half unzipped, he traced the fragile line of her collarbone with a fingertip. Her skin was cool, moist, with a film of sweat. She clung to him. He closed his eyes and saw his body in a sun-striped bed, beneath a slow fan with blades of brown hardwood. His body pumping, jerking like an amputated limb. Allison's head thrown back, mouth open, lips taut across her teeth. Angie pressed her face into the hollow of his neck. She groaned, stiffened, rocked back. "Hired man," the voice said. And he was back against the driver's seat, the Smith & Wesson's barrel reflecting a single line of green instrument glow, the luminous head of its front sight eclipsing her left pupil.
"No," the voice said.
He lowered the gun. "You're back."
"No. Legba spoke to you. I am Samadhi."
"Saturday?"
"Baron Saturday, hired man. You met me once on a hillside. The blood lay on you like dew. I drank of your full heart that day."
Her body jerked violently. "You know this town well?"
"Yes."
He watched as muscles tensed and relaxed in her face, molding her features into a new mask.
"Very well. Leave the vehicle here, as you intended, but follow the stations north, to New York. Tonight, I will guide you with Legba's horse then, and you will kill for me."
"Kill who?"
"The one you most wish to kill, hired man."
Angie moaned, shuddered, and began to sob. It's okay, he said. We're halfway home. It was a meaningless thing to say, he thought, helping her out of the seat. Neither of them had homes at all. He found the case of cartridges in the parka and replaced the one he'd used on the Honda. He found a paint-spattered razor knife in the dash toolkit and sliced the ripstop lining out of the parka, a million microtubes of poly-insulation whirling up as he cut. When he'd stripped it out, he put the Smith & Wesson in the holster and put the parka on. It hung around him in folds, like an oversized raincoat, and didn't show the bulge of the big gun at all. "Why did you do that?" she asked, running the back of her hand across her mouth. "Because it's hot out there, and I need to cover the gun." He stuffed the Ziploc full of used new yen into a pocket. "Come on," he said. "We got subways to catch." Condensation dripped steadily from the old Georgetown dome, built 40 years after the ailing Federals decamped for the lower reaches of McLean. Washington was a southern city, always had been, and you felt the tone of the sprawl shift here if you rode the trains down the stations from Boston. The trees in the district were lush and green, and their leaves shaled the arc lights as Turner and Angela Mitchell made their way along the broken sidewalks to DuPont Circle and the station. There were drums in the circle, and someone had lit a trash fire in the giant's marble goblet at the center. Silent figures sat beside spread blankets as they passed, the blankets arrayed with surreal assortments of merchandise, the damp swollen cardboard covers of black plastic audio discs beside battered prosthetic limbs trailing crude nerve jacks, a dusty glass fishbowl filled with oblong steel dog tags, rubber-banded stacks of faded postcards, cheap Indo-trodes still sealed in wholesaler's plastic, mismatched ceramic salt and pepper sets, a golf club with a peeling leather grip, Swiss Army knives with missing blades, a dented tin wastebasket lithographed with the face of a president whose name Turner could almost remember, Carter, Grosvenor, fuzzy holograms of the monument. In the shadows near the station's entrance, Turner haggled quietly with a Chinese boy in white jeans, exchanging the smallest of Rudy's bills for 9 alloy tokens stamped with the ornate BAMA transit logo. 2 of the tokens admitted them to the station. 3 of them went into vending machines for bad coffee and stale pastries. The remaining 4 carried them north, the train rushing silently along on its magnetic cushion. He sat back with his arms around her and pretended to close his eyes. He watched their reflections in the opposite window. A tall man, gaunt now and unshaven, hunched back in defeat with a hollow-eyed girl curled beside him. She hadn't spoken since they'd left the alley where he'd abandoned the hover. For the second time in an hour, he considered phoning his agent. If you had to trust someone, the rule ran, then trust your agent. But Conroy had said he'd hired Oki and the others through Turner's agent, and the connection made Turner dubious. Where was Conroy tonight? Turner was fairly certain that it would have been Conroy who ordered Oki after them with the laser. Would Hosaka have arranged the railgun in Arizona to erase evidence of a botched defection attempt? But if they had, why order Weber to destroy the medics, their neurosurgery, and the Moss Neotech deck? And there was Moss again. Had Moss killed Mitchell? Was there any reason to believe that Mitchell was really dead? Yes, he thought, as the girl stirred beside him in uneasy sleep. There was. Angie. Mitchell had feared they'd kill her. He'd arranged the defection in order to get her out, get her to Hosaka, with no plan for his own escape. For that was Angie's version, anyway. He closed his eyes, shut out the reflections. Something stirred deep in the silt of Mitchell's recorded memories. Shame. He couldn't quite reach it. He opened his eyes suddenly. What had she said at Rudy's? That her father had put the thing into her head because she wasn't smart enough? Careful not to disturb her, he worked his arm from behind her neck and slid 2 fingers into the waist pocket of his pants, came up with Conroy's little black nylon envelope on its neck cord. He undid the Velcro and shook the swollen asymmetrical gray Biosoft out onto his open palm. Machine dreams. roller coaster. Too fast, too alien to grasp. But if you wanted something, something specific, you should be able to pull it out. He dug his thumbnail under the socket's dust cover, pried it out, and put it down on the plastic seat beside him. The train was nearly empty, and none of the other passengers seemed to be paying any attention to him. He took a deep breath, set his teeth, and inserted the Biosoft. 20 seconds later, he had it, the thing he'd gone for. The strangeness hadn't touched him this time, and he decided that that was because he'd gone after this one specific thing, this fact, exactly the sort of data you'd expect to find in the dossier of a top research man. His daughter's IQ, as reflected by annual batteries of tests. Angela Mitchell was well above the norm. Had been, all along. He took the Biosoft out of his socket and rolled it absently between thumb and forefinger. The shame. Mitchell and the shame and grad school. Grades, he thought. I want the bastard's grades. I want his transcripts. He jacked the dossier again. Nothing. He'd gotten it, but there was nothing. No. Again. Again. God damn, he said, seeing it. A teenager with a shaved head glanced at him from a seat across the aisle, then turned back to the stream of his friend's monologue. They're gonna run the games again, up on the hill, midnight. We're going, but we're just gonna hang. We're not gonna make it. Just kick back and let them thump each other's butts. And we're gonna laugh, see who gets thumped. 'Cause last week Susan got her arm busted. You there for that? And it was funny, 'cause Cal was trying to take him to the hospital, but he was dusted and he ran that shitty Yamaha over a speed bump. Turner snapped the Biosoft back into his socket. This time, when it was over, he said nothing at all. He put his arm back around Angie and smiled, seeing the smile in the window. It was a feral smile. It belonged to the edge. Mitchell's academic record was good, extremely good, excellent. But the arc wasn't there. The arc was something Turner had learned to look for in the dossiers of research people. That certain signal curve of brilliance. He could spot the arc the way a master machinist could identify metals by observing the spark plume off a grinding wheel. And Mitchell hadn't had it. The shame. The graduate dorms. Mitchell had known he wasn't going to make it. And then somehow he had. How? It wouldn't be in the dossier. Mitchell, somehow, had known how to edit what he gave the Maas security machine. Otherwise, they would have been on to him. Someone, something, had found Mitchell in his postgraduate slump and had started feeding him things, clues, directions. And Mitchell had gone to the top, his arc hard and bright and perfect then, and it had carried him to the top. Who? What? He watched Angie's sleeping face in the shutter of subway light. Faust. Mitchell had cut a deed. Turner might never know the details of the agreement, or Mitchell's price, but he knew he understood the other side of it, what Mitchell had been required to do in return. Legba. Samdi. Spittle curling from the girl's contorted lips. And the train swept into Old Union in a black blast of midnight air.
Cab, sir?
The man's eyes were moving behind glasses with the polychrome tint that swirled like oil slicks. There were flat, silvery sores across the backs of his hands. Turner stepped in close and caught his upper arm without breaking stride, forcing him back against a wall of scratched white tile between gray ranks of luggage lookers. Cash, Turner said. I'm paying New Yen. I want my cab. No trouble with the driver. Understand? I'm not a mark. He tightened his grip. Fuck up on me. I'll come back here and kill you, or make you wish I had.
Got it. Yes, sir. Got it. We can do that, sir. Yes, sir. Where do you want to go, sir?
The man's wasted features contorted in pain.
Hired man.
The voice came from Angie, a hoarse whisper. And then an address. Turner saw the tout's eyes dart nervously behind the swirls of colors.
"That's Madison?" he croaked. "Yes, sir. Get you a good cab. Real good cab."
"What is this place?" Turner asked the cabbie, leaning forward to thumb the speak button beside the steel speaker grid. "The address we gave you." There was a crackle of static. "Hypermart. Not much open there this time of night. Looking for anything in particular?" "No," Turner said. He didn't know the place. He tried to remember that stretch of Madison. Residential, mostly. Uncounted living spaces, carved out of the shells of commercial buildings that dated from a day when commerce had required clerical workers to be present physically at a central location. Some of the buildings were tall enough to penetrate a dome.
"Where are we going?"
Angie asked, her hand on his arm. "It's okay," he said. "Don't worry."
"God,"
she said, leaning against his shoulder, looking up at the pink neon Hypermart sign that slashed the granite face of the old building.
"I used to dream about New York,
back on the Mesa. I had a graphics program that would take me through all the streets, into museums and things. I wanted to come here more than anything in the world." "Well, you made it. You're here." She started to sob, hugged him, her face against his bare chest, shaking.
"I'm scared. I'm so scared."
"It'll be okay," he said, stroking her hair, his eyes on the main entrance. He had no reason to believe anything would ever be okay for either of them. She seemed to have no idea that the words that had brought them here had come from her mouth. But then, he thought, she hadn't spoken them. There were bag people huddled on either side of Hypermart's entrance, prone hummocks of rag gone the exact shade of the sidewalk. They looked to Turner as though they were being slowly extruded from the dark concrete to become mobile extensions of the city. "Jammers," the voice said, muffled by his chest, and he felt a cold revulsion.
"A club.
Find Danbala's horse." And then she was crying again. He took her hand and walked past the sleeping trenches, in under the tarnished gilt scrollwork and through the glass doors. He saw an espresso machine down an aisle of tents and shuttered stalls, a girl with a black crest of hair swabbing a counter. "Coffee," he said. "Food. Come on, you need to eat." He smiled at the girl while Angie settled herself on a stool. "How about cash?" he said. "You ever take cash?" She stared at him, shrugged. He took a 20 from Rudy's Ziploc and showed it to her. "What do you want?" "Coffees, some food." "That all you got? Nothing smaller?" He shook his head. "Sorry, can't make the change." "You don't have to."
"You crazy?"
"No, but I want coffee."
"That's some tip, mister. I don't make that in a week."
"It's yours." Anger crossed her face. "You're with those shitheads upstairs. Keep your money. I'm closing." "We aren't with anybody," he said, leaning across the counter slightly so that the parka fell open and she could see the Smith & Wesson. "We're looking for a club, a place called Jammers." The girl glanced at Angie, back to Turner.
"She's sick? Dusted? What is this?"
"Here's the money," Turner said. "Give us our coffee. You want to earn the change, tell me how to find Jammer's place. It's worth it to me, understand?" She slid the worn bill out of sight and moved to the espresso machine.
"I don't think I understand anything anymore."
She rattled cups and milk-filmed glasses out of the way. "What is it with Jammers? You a friend of his? You know Jackie?" "Sure," Turner said. "She came by early this morning with this little Wilson from the Burbs. I guess they went up there." "Where?"
"Jammers. Then the weirdness started."
"Yeah?"
"All these creeps from Berrytown, greaseballs and white shoes, walking in like they owned the place. And now they damn well do, the top two floors. Started buying people out of their stalls. A lot of people on the lower floors just packed and left. Too weird."
"How many came?" Steam roared out of the machine. maybe 100. I've been scared shit all day, but I can't reach my boss. I close up in 30 minutes anyway. The day girl never showed, or else she came in, caught the trouble smell, and walked. She took the little steaming cup and put it in front of Angie. You okay, honey? Angie nodded. You have any idea what these people are up to? Turner asked. The girl had returned to the machine. It roared again. I think they're waiting for someone, she said quietly, and brought Turner an espresso. Either for someone to try to leave Jammers, or for someone to try to get in. Turner looked down at the swirls of brown foam on his coffee. And nobody here called the police? The police? Mister, this is Hypermart. People here don't call the police. Angie's cup shattered on the marble counter. Short and straight, hired man, the voice whispered. You know the way. Walk in. The counter girl's mouth was open. Jesus, she said. She's got to be dusted bad. She looked at Turner coldly. You give it to her? No, Turner said. But she's sick. It'll be okay. He drank off the black bitter coffee. It seemed to him, just for a second, that he could feel the whole sprawl breathing, and his breath was old and sick and tired, all up and down the stations from Boston to Atlanta. 28. Jaylene Slide. Jesus, Bobby said to Jackie. Can't you wrap it up or something? Jammer's burn filled the office with a smell, like overdone pork, that turned Bobby's stomach. You don't bandage a burn, she said, helping Jammer sit down in his chair. She began to open his desk drawers, one after another. You got any painkillers, derms, anything? Jammer shook his head, his long face slack and pale. Maybe. Behind the bar there's a kit. Get it, Jackie snapped. Go on. What are you so worried about him for? Bobby began, hurt by her tone. He tried to let those gothics in here. Get the box, asshole. He just got weak for a second, is all. He got scared. Give me that box, or you'll need it yourself. He darted out into the club and found Beauvoir wiring pink hot dogs of plastic explosive to a yellow plastic box like the control unit for a kid's toy truck. The hot dogs were mashed around the hinges of the door and on either side of the lock. What's that for? Bobby asked, scrambling over the bar. Somebody might want in, Beauvoir said. They do. We'll open it for them. Bobby paused to admire the arrangement. Why don't you just mash it up against the glass so it'll blow straight out? Too obvious, Beauvoir said, straightening up, the yellow detonator in his hand. But I'm glad you think about these things. If we try to blow it straight out, some of it blows back in. This way is neater. Bobby shrugged and ducked behind the bar. There were wire racks filled with plastic sacks of krill wafers, an assortment of abandoned umbrellas, an unabridged dictionary, a woman's blue shoe, a white plastic case with a runny-looking red cross painted on it with nail polish. He grabbed the case and climbed back over the bar. Hey, Jackie, he said, putting the first aid kit down beside Jammer's deck. Forget it. She popped the case open and rummaged through its contents. Jammer, there's more poppers in here than anything else. Jammer smiled weakly. Here, these'll do you. She unrolled a sheet of red derms and began to peel them off the backing, smoothing three across the back of the burnt hand. What you need's a local, though. I was thinking, Jammer said, staring up at Bobby. Maybe now is when you can earn yourself a little running time. How's that? Bobby asked, eyeing the deck. Stands to reason, Jammer said, that whoever's got those jerks outside, they've also got the phones tapped. Bobby nodded. Beauvoir had said the same thing when he'd run his plan down to them. Well, when Beauvoir and I decided you and I might hit the Matrix for a little look-see, I actually had something else in mind. Jammer showed Bobby his expanse of small white teeth. See, I'm in this because I owed Beauvoir and Lucas a favor. But there are people who owe me favors, too. Favors that go way back. Favors I never needed to call in.
Jammer, Jackie said, you gotta relax. Just sit back. You could go into shock.
How's your memory, Bobby? I'm going to run a sequence by you. You practice it on my deck. No power, not jacked, okay? Bobby nodded. So dry run this a couple of times. Entrance code. Let you in the back door.
Whose back door?
Bobby spun the black deck around and poised his fingers above the keyboard. The Yakuza, Jammer said. Jackie was staring at him.
Hey, what do you...
Like I said, it's an old favor. But you know what they say, the Yakuza never forget. Cuts both ways. A whiff of singed flesh reached Bobby and he winced.
How come you didn't mention this to Beauvoir?
Jackie was folding things back into the white case. Honey, Jammer said, you'll learn. Some things you teach yourself to remember to forget. Now look, Bobby said, fixing Jackie with what he hoped was his heaviest look. I'm running this, so I don't need your Loas, okay? They get on my nerves. She doesn't call them up, Beauvoir said, crouching by the office door, the detonator in one hand and the South African riot gun in the other. They just come. They want to come, they're there. Anyway, they like you. Jackie settled the trodes across her forehead.
Bobby, she said, you'll be fine. Don't worry, just Jack.
She'd removed her headscarf. Her hair was cornrowed between neat furrows of shiny brown skin, with antique resistors woven in at random intervals, little cylinders of brown phenolic resin ringed with color-coded bands of paint. When you punch out past the basketball, Jammer said to Bobby, you want to dive right 3 clicks and go for the floor. I mean straight down.
Past the what?
Basketball. That's the Dallas-Fort Worth Sunbelt Co-Prosperity Sphere. You want to get your ass down fast, all the way. Then you run how I told you, for about 20 clicks. It's all used car lots and tax accountants down there, but just stand on that mother, okay? Bobby nodded, grinning. Anybody sees you going by? Well, that's their lookout. People who jack down there are used to seeing some weird shit anyway. Man, Beauvoir said to Bobby, get it on. I gotta get back to the door. Bobby jacked. He followed Jammer's instructions, secretly grateful that he could feel Jackie beside him as they plunged down into the workaday depths of cyberspace, the glowing basketball dwindling above them. The deck was quick, super slick, and it made him feel fast and strong. He wondered how Jammer had come to have the Yakuza owing him a favor, one he'd never bothered to collect, and a part of him was busily construing scenarios when they hit the ice.
Jesus!
And Jackie was gone. Something had come down between them, something he felt as cold and silent and a shutting off of breath.
But there wasn't anything there, goddammit!
He was frozen somehow, locked steady. He could still see the matrix, but he couldn't feel his hands.
Why the hell anybody plugged the likes of you into a deck like that? Thing ought to be in a museum. You ought to be in grade school. Jackie!
The cry was reflex.
Man, said the voice, I don't know. It's been a long few days I haven't slept, but you sure don't look like what I was set to catch when you came out of there. How old are you?
Fuck off, Bobby said. It was all he could think of to say. The voice began to laugh. Ramirez would split his sides at this, you know. He had him a fine sense of the ridiculous. That's one of the things I miss.
Who's Ramirez?
My partner. X. Dead. Very. I was thinking maybe you could tell me how he got that way.
Never heard of him, Bobby said.
Where's Jackie? Sitting cold-cocked in cyberspace while you answer my questions, Wilson. What's your name?
Count Zero.
Sure. Your name?
Bobby.
Bobby Newmark. Silence. Then, well, hey, does make a little sense then. That was your mother's place I watched those moss spooks use the rocket on, wasn't it? But I guess you weren't there, or you wouldn't be here. Hold on a sec. A square of cyberspace directly in front of him flipped sickeningly, and he found himself in a pale blue graphic that seemed to represent a very spacious apartment, low shapes of furniture sketched in hair-fine lines of blue neon. A woman stood in front of him, a sort of glowing cartoon squiggle of a woman, the face a brown smudge. "I'm Slide," the figure said, hands on its hips. "Jaylene. You don't fuck with me. Nobody in L.A. She gestured, a window suddenly snapping into existence behind her. "Fucks with me. You got that?" "Right," Bobby said. "What is this? I mean, if you could sort of explain..." He still couldn't move. The window showed a blue-gray video view of palm trees and old buildings. "How do you mean?" "This sort of drawing. And you. And that old picture." "Hey, man, I paid a designer an arm and a leg to punch this up for me. This is my space, my construct. This is L.A., boy. People here don't do anything without jacking. This is where I entertain." "Oh," Bobby said, still baffled. "Your turn. Who's back there in that sleaze-ass dance hall?"
"Jammers?"
"Me, Jackie, Beauvoir, Jammer. And where were you headed when I grabbed you?" Bobby hesitated. "The Yakuza. Jammer has a code."
"What for?"
The figure moved forward, an animated, sensuous brush sketch.
"Help!"
"Shit, you're probably telling the truth."
I am, swear to God."
"Well, you ain't what I need, Bobby Zero. I've been out cruising cyberspace, all up and down, trying to find out who killed my man. I thought it was Mas, because we were taking one of theirs for Hosaka, so I hunted up a spook team of theirs. First thing I saw was what they did to your mama's condo. Then I saw three of them drop in on a man they call the Finn, but those three never came back out."
"Finn killed him," Bobby said. "I saw him. Dead."
"You did? Well, then, could be we do have things to talk about." "After that, I watched the other three use that same launcher on a pimpmobile."
"That was Lucas," he said.
"But no sooner had they done it than a copter overflew them and fried all three with a laser. You know anything about that?"
"No."
"You think you can tell me your story, Bobby Zero? Make it quick."
"I was gonna do this run, see? And I'd got this icebreaker off Two-A-Day, from up the projects, and I..."
When he finished, she was silent. The slinky cartoon figure stood by the window, as though she were studying the television trees.
"I got an idea," he ventured. "Maybe you can help us."
"No," she said.
"But maybe it'll help you find out what you want."
"No. I just want to kill the motherfucker who killed Ramirez."
"But we're trapped in there. They're gonna kill us. It's Mas, the people you were following around in the Matrix. They hired a bunch of casuals and gothics."
"That's not Mas," she said. "That's a bunch of Euros over on Park Avenue. Ice on them a mile deep." Bobby took that in.
"They the ones in the copter? The ones killed the other Mas guys?"
"No. I couldn't get a fix on that copter, and they flew south. Lost them. I have a hunch, though. Anyway, I'm sending you back. You want to try that Yak code, go ahead."
"But, lady, we need help."
"No percentage in help, Bobby Zero," she said. And then he was sitting in front of Jammer's deck, the muscles in his neck and back aching. It took him a while before he could get his eyes to focus, so it was nearly a minute before he saw that there were strangers in the room. The man was tall, maybe taller than Lucas, but rangier, narrower at the hips. He wore a kind of baggy combat jacket that hung around him in folds, with giant pockets, and his chest was bare except for a horizontal black strap. His eyes looked bruised and feverish, and he held the biggest handgun Bobby had ever seen, a kind of distended revolver with some weird fixture molded under the barrel, a thing like a cobra's head. Beside him, swaying, stood a girl who might have been Bobby's age, with the same bruised eyes, though hers were dark, and lank brown hair that needed to be washed. She wore a black sweatshirt, several sizes too large, and jeans. The man reached out with his left hand and steadied her. Bobby stared, then gaped as the memory hit him. Girl voice, brown hair, dark eyes, the ice eating into him, his teeth burring. Her voice, the big thing leaning in. "Vive la Vierge," Jackie said, beside him, rapt, her hand gripping his shoulder hard. "The Virgin of Miracles. She's come, Bobby. Don Bala has sent her." "You were under a while, kid," the tall man said to Bobby. "What happened?" Bobby blinked, glanced frantically around, found Jammer's eyes glazed with drugs and pain. "Tell him," Jammer said. "I couldn't get to the yacht. Somebody grabbed me. I don't know how." "Who?" The tall man had his arm around the girl now. "She said her name was Slide, from Los Angeles." "Jaylene," the man said. The phone on Jammer's desk began to chime. "Answer it," the man said. Bobby turned as Jackie reached over and tapped the call bar below the square screen. The screen lit, flickered, and showed them a man's face, broad and very pale, the eyes hooded and sleepy-looking. His hair was bleached nearly white and brushed straight back. He had the meanest mouth Bobby had ever seen. "Turner," the man said, "we'd better talk now. You haven't got a lot of time left. I think you should get those people out of the room for starts." 29. Boxmaker. The knotted line stretched on and on. At times they came to angles, forks of the tunnel. Here the line would be wrapped around a strut or secured with a fat, transparent gob of epoxy. The air was as stale but colder. When they stopped to rest in a cylindrical chamber, where the shaft widened before a triple branching, Marley asked Jones for the flat little work light he wore across his forehead on a gray elastic strap. Holding it in one of the red suit's gauntlets, she played it over the chamber's wall. The surface was etched with patterns, microscopically fine lines. "Put your helmet on," Jones advised. "You've got a better light than mine." Marley shuddered.
"No."
She passed him the light.
"Can you help me out of this, please?"
She tapped a gauntlet against the suit's hard chest. The mirror-domed helmet was fastened to the suit's waist with a chrome snap-hook.
"You'd best keep it," Jones said. "It's the only one in the place. I've got one where I sleep, but no air for it. Wiggs' bottles won't fit my transpirator, and his suit's all holes."
He shrugged.
"No, please," she said, struggling with the catch at the suit's waist, where she'd seen Rez twist something. "I can't stand it."
Jones pulled himself half over the line and did something she couldn't see. There was a click.
"Stretch your arms over your head," he said. It was awkward, but finally she floated free, still in the black jeans and white silk blouse she'd worn to that final encounter with Alain.
Jones fastened the empty red suit to the line with another of the snap rings mounted around its waist, and then undid her bulging purse.
"You want this? To take with you, I mean. We could leave it here, get it on our way back."
"No," she said, "I'll take it. Give it to me."
She hooked an elbow around the line and fumbled the purse open. Her jacket came out, but so did one of her boots. She managed to get the boot back into the purse, then twisted herself into the jacket.
"That's a nice piece of hide," Jones said.
"Please," she said, "let's hurry."
"Not far now," he said, his work light swinging to show her where the line vanished through one of three openings arranged in an equilateral triangle.
"End of the line," he said. "Literal, that is." He tapped the chromed eye bolt where the line was tied in a sailor's knot. His voice caught and echoed, somewhere ahead of them, until she imagined she heard other voices whispering behind the round of echo. "We'll want a bit of light for this," he said, kicking himself across the shaft and catching a gray metal coffin thing that protruded there. He opened it. She watched his hands move in the bright circle of the work light. His fingers were thin and delicate, but the nails were small and blunt, outlined with black impacted grime. The letters CJ were tattooed in crude blue across the back of his right hand. The sort of tattoo one did oneself, in jail. Now he'd fished out a length of heavy insulated wire. He squinted into the box, then wedged the wire behind a copper D-connector. The dark ahead vanished in a white flood of light. "Got more power than we need, really," he said, with something akin to a homeowner's pride. "The solar banks are all still working, and they were meant to power the mainframes." "Come on, then, lady. We'll meet the artist you come so far to see." He kicked off and out, gliding smoothly through the opening, like a swimmer into the light. Into the thousand drifting things. She saw that the red plastic soles of his frayed shoes had been patched with smears of white silicon caulking. And then she'd followed, forgetting her fears, forgetting the nausea and constant vertigo. And she was there, and she understood.
"My God," she said.
"Not likely," Jones called. "Maybe old wigs, though. Too bad it's not doing it now, though. That's even more of a sight." Something slid past, 10 centimeters from her face. An ornate silver spoon, sawn precisely in half, from end to end. She had no idea how long she'd been there when the screen lit and began to flicker. Hours, minutes. She'd already learned to negotiate the chamber after a fashion, kicking off like Jones from the dome's concavity. Like Jones, she caught herself on the thing's folded, jointed arms, pivoted and clung there, watching the swirl of debris. There were dozens of the arms, manipulators, tipped with pliers, hex drivers, knives, a sub-miniature circular saw, a dentist's drill. They bristled from the alloy thorax of what must once have been a construction remote, the sort of unmanned, semi-autonomous device she knew from childhood videos of the high frontier. But this one was welded into the apex of the dome, its sides fused with the fabric of the place, and hundreds of cables and optic lines snaked across the geodesics to enter it. Two of the arms, tipped with delicate force feedback devices, were extended. The soft pads cradled an unfinished box. Eyes wide, Marley watched the uncounted things swing past. A yellowing kid glove, the faceted crystal stopper from some vial of vanished perfume, an armless doll with a face of French porcelain, a fat, gold-fitted black fountain pen, rectangular segments of perf board, the crumpled red and green snake of a silk cravat. Endless, the slow swarm, the spinning things. Jones tumbled up through the silent storm, laughing, grabbing an arm tipped with a glue gun. "Always makes me want to laugh to see it, but the boxes always make me sad."
"Yes," she said, "they make me sad, too, but there are sadnesses and sadnesses."
"Quite right," he grinned. "No way to make it go, though. Guess the spirit has to move it, or anyway, that's how old Wig has it. He used to come out here a lot. I think the voices are stronger for him here. But lately they've been talking to him wherever, it seems like." She looked at him through the thicket of manipulators. He was very dirty, very young, with his wide blue eyes under a tangle of brown curls. He wore a stained gray zip suit, its collar shiny with grime.
"You must be mad," she said, with something like admiration in her voice. "You must be totally mad to stay here."
He laughed. "Wiggins madder than a sack of bugs, not me." She smiled.
"No, you're crazy. I'm crazy, too."
"Hello, then," he said, looking past her. "What's this? One of Wig's sermons, looks like, and no way we can shut it off without me cutting the power." She turned her head and saw diagonals of color strobe across the rectangular face of a large screen glued crookedly to the curve of the dome. The screen was occluded, for a second, by the passage of a dressmaker's dummy, and then the face of Josef Virek filled it, his soft blue eyes glittering behind round lenses. "Hello, Marley," he said. "I can't see you, but I'm sure I know where you are." "That's one of Wig's sermon screens," Jones said, rubbing his face. "Put 'em up all over the place, 'cause he figured one day he'd have people up here to preach to. This geezer's linked in through Wig's communication gear, I guess. Who is he?"
"Virek," she said.
Thought he was older.
"It's a generated image," she said. "Ray tracing, texture mapping."
She stared as the face smiled out at her from the curve of the dome, beyond the slow-motion hurricane of lost things, minor artifacts of countless lives, tools and toys and gilded buttons. "I want you to know," the image said, "that you have fulfilled your contract. My psychoprofile of Marley Krushkova predicted your response to my gestalt. Broader profiles indicated that your presence in Paris would force Mas to play their hand. Soon, Marley, I will know exactly what it is that you have found. For 4 years I've known something that Mas didn't know. I've known that Mitchell, the man Mas and the world regards as the inventor of the new biochip processes, was being fed the concepts that resulted in his breakthroughs. I added you to an intricate array of factors, Marley, and things came to a most satisfying head. Mas, without understanding what they were doing, surrendered the location of the conceptual source. And you have reached it. Paco will be arriving shortly."
"You said you wouldn't follow," she said. "I knew you lied."
"And now, Marley, at last I think I shall be free. Free of the 400 kilograms of rioting cells they wall away behind surgical steel in a Stockholm industrial park. Free, eventually, to inhabit any number of real bodies, Marley. Forever." "Shit," Jones said. "This one's as bad as Wig. What's he think he's talking about?"
"About his jump," she said, remembering her talk with Andrea, the smell of cooking prawns in the cramped little kitchen. "The next stage of his evolution."
"You understand it?"
"No," she said. "But I know that it will be bad, very bad."
She shook her head. "Convince the inhabitants of the cores to admit Paco and his crew, Marley," Virek said. "I purchased the cores an hour before you departed Orly from a contractor in Pakistan. A bargain, Marley, a great bargain. Paco will oversee my interests, as usual." And then the screen was dark. "Here now," Joan said, pivoting around a folded manipulator and taking her hand. "What's so bad about all that? He owns it now, and he said you'd done your bit. I don't know what old Wig's good for, except to listen to the voices, but he's not long for this side anyway. Me, I'm as easy for out as not."
"You don't understand," she said. "You can't. He's found his way to something. Something he's sought for years. But nothing he wants can be good. For anyone. I've seen him. I've felt it."
And then the steel arm she held vibrated and began to move, the whole turret rotating with a muted hum of servos. 30. Hired Man. Turner stared at Conroy's face on the screen of the office phone. "Go on," he said to Angie. "You go with her." The tall black girl with the resistors woven into her hair stepped forward and gently put her arm around Mitchell's daughter, crooning something in that same click-infested Creole. The kid in the T-shirt was still gaping at her, his jaw slack.
"Come on, Bobby," the black girl said.
Turner glanced across the desk at the man with the wounded hand, who wore a wrinkled white evening jacket and a bolo tie with thongs of braided black leather. Jammer, Turner decided, the club owner. Jammer cradled his hand in his lap on a blue-striped towel from the bar. He had a long face, the kind of beard that needed constant shaving, and the hard, narrow eyes of a stone professional. As their eyes met, Turner realized that the man sat well out of the line of the phone's camera, his swivel chair pushed back into a corner. The kid in the T-shirt, Bobby, shuffled out behind Angie and the black girl, his mouth still open. "You could have saved us both a lot of hassle, Turner," Conroy said. "You could have called me. You could have called your agent in Geneva." "How about Hosaka?" Turner said. "Could I have called them?" Conroy shook his head slowly. "Who are you working for, Conroy? You went double on this one, didn't you?" "But not on you, Turner. If it had gone down the way I planned it, you'd have been in Bogota with Mitchell. The railgun couldn't fire until the jet was out, and if we cut it right, Hosaka would have figured Moss took the whole sector out to stop Mitchell. But Mitchell didn't make it, did he, Turner?"
"He never planned to," Turner said.
Conroy nodded. "Yeah. And the security on the mesa picked up the girl going out. That's her, isn't it? Mitchell's daughter." Turner was silent. "Sure," Conroy said. "Figures." "I killed Lynch," Turner said, to steer the subject away from Angie. "But just before the hammer came down, Weber told me she was working for you." "They both were," Conroy said. "But neither one knew about the other." He shrugged.
"What for?"
Conroy smiled. "Because you'd have missed them if they weren't there, wouldn't you? Because you know my style, and if I hadn't been flying all my usual colors, you'd have started to wonder. And I knew you'd never sell out. Mr. Instant Loyalty, right? Mr. Bushido. You were bankable, Turner. Hosaka knew that. That's why they insisted I bring you in." "You haven't answered my first question, Conroy. Who did you go double for?"
"A man named Virek," Conroy said. "The money man.
That's right, same one. He'd been trying to buy Mitchell for years. For that matter, he'd been trying to buy Moss. No go. They're getting so rich he couldn't touch them. There was a standing offer for Mitchell making the rounds, a blind offer. When Hosaka heard from Mitchell and called me in, I decided to check that offer out, just out of curiosity. But before I could, Virek's team was on me. It wasn't a hard deal to cut, Turner, believe me."
"I believe you."
"But Mitchell fucked us all over, didn't he, Turner? Good and solid."
"So they killed him."
"He killed himself," Conroy said, "according to Virek's moles on the mesa. As soon as he saw the kid off in that ultralight, cut his throat with a scalpel."
"A lot of dead people around, Conroy," Turner said. "Oki's dead, and the Jap who was flying that copter for you."
"Figured that when they didn't come back," Conroy shrugged.
"They were trying to kill us," Turner said.
"No, man, they just wanted to talk. Anyway, we didn't know about the girl then. We just knew you were gone and that the damn jet hadn't made it to the strip in Bogota. We didn't start thinking about the girl until we took a look at your brother's farm and found the jet. Your brother wouldn't tell Oki anything. Pissed off 'cause Oki burned his dogs. Oki said it looked like a woman had been living there too, but she didn't turn up."
"What about Rudy?"
Conroy's face was a perfect blank. Then he said, "Oki got what he needed off the monitors. Then we knew about the girl."
Turner's back was aching. The holster strap was cutting into his chest. "I don't feel anything," he thought. "I don't feel anything at all."
"I've got a question for you, Turner. I've got a couple, but the main one is, what the fuck are you doing in there?"
"Heard it was a hot club, Conroy."
"Yeah, real exclusive. So exclusive you had to break up two of my doormen to get in. They knew you were coming, Turner. The Spades and that punk. Why else would they let you in?"
"You'll have to work that one out, Connie. You seem to have a lot of access these days."
Conroy leaned closer to his phone's camera. "You bet your ass. Virek's had people all over the sprawl for months, feeling out a rumor.
cowboy gossip that there was an experimental biosoft floating around. Finally, his people focused on the fin, but another team, a Moss team, turned up, obviously after the same thing. So Virek's team just kicked back and watched the Moss boys, and the Moss boys started blowing people away. So Virek's team picked up on the spades and little Bobby and the whole thing. They laid it all out for me when I told them I figured you'd headed this way from Rudy's. When I saw where they were headed, I hired some muscle to ice them in there until I could get somebody I could trust to go in after them. Those dusters out there? Turner smiled. You just dropped the ball, Connie. You can't go anywhere for professional help, can you? Somebody's twigged that you doubled, and a lot of pros died out there. So you're hiring shitheads with funny haircuts. The pros have all heard you've got Hosaka after your ass, haven't they, Connie? And they all know what you did. Turner was grinning now. Out of the corner of his eye, he saw that the man in the dinner jacket was smiling, too. A thin smile with lots of neat small teeth, like white grains of corn. It's that bitch Slide, Conroy said. I could have taken her out on the rig. She punched her way in somewhere and started asking questions. I don't even think she's really onto it yet, but she's been making sounds in certain circles. Anyway, yeah, you got the picture. But it doesn't help your ass any, not now. Virek wants the girl. He's pulled his people off the other thing, and now I'm running things for him. Money, Turner. Money like a zaibatsu. Turner stared at the face, remembering Conroy in the bar of a jungle hotel. Remembering him later in Los Angeles, making his pass, explaining the covert economics of corporate defection. Hi, Connie, Turner said. I know you, don't I? Conroy smiled. Sure, baby. And I know the offer. Already. You want the girl. That's right. And the split, Connie. You know I only work 50-50, right? Hey, Conroy said, this is the big one. I wouldn't have it any other way. Turner stared at the man's image. Well, Conroy said, still smiling, what do you say? And Jammer reached out and pulled the phone's line from the wall plug. Timing, he said. Timing's always important. He let the plug drop. If you'd told him, he'd have moved right away. This way buys us time. He'll try to get back, try to figure what happened. How do you know what I was going to say? Because I seen people. I seen a lot of them, too fucking many. Particularly, I seen a lot like you. You got it written across your face, mister. And you were going to tell him he could eat shit and die. Jammer hunched his way up in the office chair, grimacing as his hand moved inside the bar towel. Who's this Slide he was talking about? A jockey? Jaylene Slide, Los Angeles. Top Gun. She was the one hijacked Bobby, Jammer said. So she's damn close to your pal on the phone. She probably doesn't know it, though. Let's see what we can do about that. Get the boy back in here. 31. Voices. I'd better find old Wig, he said. She was watching the manipulators, hypnotized by the way they moved. As they picked through the swirl of things, they also caused it, grasping and rejecting. The rejected objects whirling away, striking others, drifting into new alignments. The process stirred them gently, slowly, perpetually. I'd better, he said. What? Go find Wig. He might get up to something, if your boss man's people turn up. Don't want him to hurt himself, you know. He looked sheepish, vaguely embarrassed. Fine, she said. I'm fine. I'll watch. She remembered the Wig's mad eyes. The craziness she'd felt roll off him in waves. She remembered the ugly cunning she'd sensed in his voice over the Sweet Jane's radio. Why would Jones show this kind of concern? But then she thought about what it would be like living in the place, the dead cores of Tessier Ashpool. Anything human, anything alive, might come to seem quite precious here.
You're right, she said. Go and find him.
The boy smiled nervously and kicked off, tumbling for the opening where the line was anchored. I'll come back for you, he said. Remember where we left your suit. The turret swung back and forth, humming, the manipulators darting, finishing the new poem. She was never certain, afterward, that the voices were real, but eventually she came to feel that they had been a part of one of those situations in which real becomes merely another concept. She'd taken off her jacket because the air in the dome seemed to have grown warmer, as though the ceaseless movement of the arms generated heat. She'd anchored the jacket and her purse on a strut beside the sermon screen. The box was nearly finished now, she thought, although it moved so quickly in the padded claws that it was difficult to see. Abruptly it floated free, tumbling end over end, and she sprang for it instinctively, caught it, and went tumbling past the flashing arms, her treasure in her arms. Unable to slow herself, she struck the far side of the dome, bruising her shoulder and tearing her blouse. Drifting, stunned, she cradled the box, staring through the rectangle of glass at an arrangement of brown old maps and tarnished mirror. The seas of the cartographers had been cut away, exposing the flaking mirrors, land masses afloat on dirty silver. She looked up in time to see a glittering arm snag the floating sleeve of her Brussels jacket. Her purse, half a meter behind it and tumbling gracefully, went next, hooked by a manipulator tipped with an optic sensor and a simple claw. She watched as her things were drawn into the ceaseless dance of the arms. Minutes later, the jacket came whirling out again. Neat squares and rectangles seemed to have been cut away, and she found herself laughing. She released the box she held. "Go ahead," she said. "I am honored." The arms whirled and flashed, and she heard the whine of a tiny saw. "I am honored, I am honored, I am honored," echo of her voice in the dome setting up a shifting forest of smaller, partial sounds, and behind them, very faint, voices. "You're here, aren't you?" she called, adding to the ring of sound, ripples and reflections of her fragmented voice. "Yes, I am here." "Wigan would say you've always been here, wouldn't he?" "Yes, but it isn't true. I came to be here. Once I was not. Once, for a brilliant time, time without duration, I was everywhere as well. But the bright time broke. The mirror was flawed. Now I am only one. But I have my song, and you have heard it. I sing with these things that float around me, fragments of the family that funded my birth. There are others, but they will not speak to me. Vain, the scattered fragments of myself, like children, like men. They send me new things, but I prefer the old things. Perhaps I do their bidding. They plot with men, my other selves, and men imagine they are gods." End of Side 6. To continue, change side selector switch and turn the cassette over.